June 21st. Hopefully this is the beginning of the end. I have, since I saw Representative Nelson's note first, Representative Nelson, why don't you come on up? And we will open a public hearing on 3419. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us a little bit about the bill? Any other legislators wishing to testify on House Bill 3419? Representative Riley, come on up.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Committee. House Bill 3419A provides that a sex offender on probation, parole, or some other form of post-prison supervision can't reside in a dwelling where another sex offender resides unless certain conditions are met, and we have a conflict amendment that we need to adopt should we pass this bill.
Great. Thank you. Take it away.
Chair Brown, Senator Shields, and Tiffany.
And we're officially in subcommittee for a few more minutes. So go ahead.
Thank you for having this hearing today on House Bill 3419. I'm proud to sit here by another co-sponsor, but I'm deeply concerned about our situation in our state with sex offenders. I live in a county that has 365 predators, a population of about 83,000. Most recently, in doing a seminar on this subject, I found that we have a group of 18 sex offenders living together right across from a brand new park that was constructed by our Rotary Club, and we're so grateful. So it is my hope that this bill comes to pass, because we do know in our research that one way to continue this predatory nature of these sex offenders is to continually have a companionship with others who are in this same creepy, crummy, scroungy, rotten business of sex offending. And I appreciate you passing this.
Thank you. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Chair Brown, members of the committee. For the record, Chuck Riley representing Hillsborough, Cornelius Forest Grove. Thank you for allowing me to testify today on this important issue of cohabitation of sex offenders. I'm here today in support of House Bill 3419, which would restrict the cohabitation of sex offenders without supervision. I'm a proud co-sponsor of House Bill 3419, together with good Representative Derek Kitts. It is not only a good common sense bill, but also a truly bipartisan bill. Chair Brown, members of the committee, this bill deserves your support. The bill reflects my and Representative Kitts' answer to a local problem. The concerned citizens of Hillsborough brought this issue to Representative Kitts and me after a single-family home in our community became the residence of 8 recently paroled sex offenders. The owner of the house is now relocated to the city of Cornelius, and this bill will help to put an end to this practice of renting out to multiple convicted sex offenders before he does the same thing again and again in communities all across the state. I'm deeply concerned about this many sex offenders living together without any supervision or treatment. We as legislators must pass laws that set communities and citizens up for success, not tragedy. Allowing sex offenders to live together without supervision is dangerous and unfair to the surrounding community. I urge you to pass House Bill 3419 and help protect our communities from a frightening and potentially dangerous situation. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Kitts.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I am that good Representative Derek Kitts that the former Representative Riley spoke of. I don't know what I can add that hasn't already been added. Appreciate the support of the county corrections folks in working with us to amend the bill from its original form and work with us and with regards to the potential problems that other bill potentially may have had, and to skate through the legislative process on the House side with virtually, I believe, it was a unanimous vote. And so it's truly a work in progress that allows the citizens of our community to engage in the legislative process. So appreciate your support on the bill. Appreciate you hearing the bill. And it's a good bill. Should pass.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel?
Yeah.
Senator Shields.
For the record, Representative Kitts, quickly, what was that difference between the original bill amendment. I assume you're talking about dash 2?
Yes. Originally, it prohibited just a general prohibition on cohabitation of sex offenders. Some data was brought forward that really said, you know, that's not necessarily a bad thing, but that the issue lied in the supervision of and the recidivism rate when cohabitation takes place is actually, the study that was brought forward shows that the probability is diminished at that point with two. So and one of the questions that Jeff Barker, Representative Barker raised was, what if they're married? You're saying that two married people can't, and if both in violation of this, you would essentially may run into some issues. So,
Senator Shields.
Just to follow up, the key word there is supervision. And if you have a halfway house or something that's set up to deal with these problems, that's not affected. It's the without supervision part.
And Senator, Madam Chair, and Senator, those provisions are directly addressed in the bill
right.
For that exact reason. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Yell. All right. Anybody else in the audience? I think we're done with the three of you. Anyone else in the audience wishing to testify on House Bill 3419? Why don't you come on up? Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Chair Brown and members of the committee. My name is Patrick Schreiner. I'm the commander of the Parole and Probation Division for the Marion County Sheriff's Office, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors and the Sex Offender Supervision Network to testify in support of this bill. We worked pretty hard with Representative Kitts to craft this bill to what we think would meet best practices. We do know that in the kind of housing that sex offenders have, supportive housing, when they have support and supervision and treatment, they're more successful. In fact, we can tell you that sex offenders on supervision have recidivism rates in the state of around 5%, which is significantly lower than any other population. So we also, Representative Kitts cited the Colorado study that indicated people living in supportive housing where there was supervision and treatment tended to tell on each other. They tended to tell on each other when they had contact. They tended to tell on each other when they violated their probation or their conditions regarding staying away from kids and those kind of things. So they actually had a positive impact. And it was mentioned that we have halfway houses. We do not have halfway houses in Oregon. We haven't had halfway houses since about 1979. That would be a significant funding issue when people would come out of prison and there was staff and funding for that. So very often you're talking about faith-based communities or private entrepreneurs who established houses and rent to sex offenders. What this bill will do is require community corrections to approve those places, look at the offenders that are going to be there, consult with the treatment provider and support, and also work with the community, which makes perfect sense.
Mr. Schreiner, when you said we don't have halfway houses, we don't have halfway houses because we've chosen not to fund them. Is that correct?
That is correct, Senator.
All right. Questions for Mr. Schreiner? Thank you very much.
Thank you
for joining us today. Anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 3419? I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3419. Let's move to 3443. Let's open a public hearing officially in full committee on House Bill 3443. Representative Nelson?
She did it. Do you want to hold on?
Chair Brown. Good afternoon again.
Oh, good afternoon, Donna Nelson, State Representative District 24. Senator Brown and Chair Brown and Senators and Tiffany again, thank you for hearing this bill. I am so excited about this bill. I myself was the sponsor of this bill three terms ago and was delighted to find out in the state of Oregon that there is a 211 coalition. And at my at that time, in 2001, my greatest concern was for the hungry. And I had felt that if a little child anywhere in the state of Oregon could pick up the phone and dial 211, he could immediately be connected with his local food bank. No little child, no senior, no disabled person would have to go hungry because they didn't know whom to contact. Well, after following that year and great discussion, I was delighted to find out that three cities and one in the state, three in Oregon and one in Washington, have gone ahead and put 211 in operation, I hope, and long for Yamhill County to do so, should the state not proceed to do so. But this is a wonderful bill. It's an essential emergency device, I guess we could say, having the system. It's a dedicated number, and it can provide immediate responsiveness to those in need and those in emergencies by connecting them with the most appropriate and proper service here and at the state. This is an excellent bill. We should move forward with this. It's long overdue.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Representative Nelson?
There isn't any opposition, is there?
No. Senator Shields, we have a couple other people that wish to testify, but we have a number of legislators in the room, so I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3443. Sorry, Representative Thatcher, Representative Gilman, I got Senator Bates who's got to get back to committee. Let's open a public hearing on House Bill 3482. Senator Bates, why don't you come on up and tell us about the bill?
Bill?
Is this the defibrillator bill?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Representative Haas, are you on this bill as well? Come on up. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and in the hopes of getting his bill through, happy birthday.
Thank you. Now, people will understand why I'm sitting in front of them eating ice cream.
Yeah,
so.
Good reason for it. And thank you for letting us go first. I'm in another committee right now. I need to get back to it, so I'm going to speak quickly and then leave. This is the third time I've had the opportunity to testify on this bill, and I think if I have to do it one more time, as my good friend, my nurse in the back, said, I'll probably need to be defibrillated myself. So I'm going to get through this as quickly as I can for you. These machines are really a medical, from my point of view, a medical necessity and a medical necessity. Prior to having these available to us, people would commonly go into what's called ventricular fibrillation and die suddenly. It was one of the leading, if not the leading, cause of sudden death for people. Amen. These deaths usually occur during times of heavy activity. It can happen to people of any age, including children, teenagers, young adults, and the elderly. Getting these located near where people exercise on a regular basis is extremely important because it saves lives. And we are moving forward slowly in our society to get these out to where they need to be used. Machines are incredibly easy to use. We took one of these sets to a fifth grade class one time, put it in front of the kids and said, how would you use this and what is it for? Within 15, 20 minutes, they had it figured out and could use the machine. So that was no training whatsoever. People are easily trained this and it can be used easily. Some of the things you might hear about it in a negative fashion just really aren't true. You might hear that delays treatment some way, that people forget to call 911, they forget to do the normal things you do in emergency situations. That has not proven to be the case. These machines have been used carefully and well and have saved lives. We've had two deaths that this bill will memorialize. Let other members of the group here speak to them. It's from my point of view important that we get these in all public buildings, not just schools and as this bill requires health clubs. But this is a first step. This does not allocate any money for it. It simply says that schools can go out and get grants to fund these and bring them in. Machines are still fairly expensive. They are roughly $2,000 a piece, but they are life saving. They're permanent machines. You have to maintain them on an annual basis, as far as bags are concerned. But they're easy to use, and once you get them in your buildings, you feel much more secure with them. I've not had an opportunity to use one of these machines on a permanent basis yet, but I know other my friends have, and they work extremely well and are easy to use. I'm glad to take any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Bates. I just this issue is very personal for me. My father is alive today because of a defibrillator. He had a cardiac arrest while he was playing tennis. If they hadn't had a defibrillator in the club, he wouldn't be here. So, anyway, I feel this one very personally. Representative Haas.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I be excused?
You may be excused. Thank you very much.
Right pads the patient's bare chest.
You need someone with a bare chest.
Plug-in and connector.
Mark Hass, House Representative 27. If someone needed help, was on the ground right now,
mm-hmm.
you put this on there, and you wait for this to do its job, and it will, through its own computer system, determine whether it's needed or not, and whether
apply
it's
pad, plug in, connect.
It also knows when you do something wrong.
Yes.
Analyzing heart rhythm. Do not touch the patient.
So you all know, we have two of these here in the state capitol. Most schools do not have
analyzing
them,
heart rhythm.
Except for places where parents have decided that they
no
want
shock
one.
Shock advised.
Okay, see this
said safe to touch the patient. Your way. Check.
The point is it's very easy to use, and it won't work if there's not an arrhythmia in the heart. That's the point I wanted to make. And a lot of people haven't even seen that demonstration that it is so easy. This bill might look familiar to some of you because it passed unanimously over here. It was modified over in the House and put into another bill, and the part that you voted on is still there, which is essentially what Dr. Bates talked about. In addition, the House added a requirement that defibrillators be placed in health clubs where there's at least 100 users per day, and there is a Good Samaritan language in it that allows schools to keep these on the premises without having to worry about lawsuits. The Heart Association believes that widespread distribution of defibrillators would save 100,000 lives every year in this country. And I have heard many stories like your father's. I've done conferences about this where people get up to the microphone and they start out saying, hello, my name is such and such, and 6 months ago I died, but thanks to one of these, I'm back here to tell this story. Richard Lazar has the technical side of this.
Mr. Lazar, take it away.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to be here. I am Richard Lazar. I'm a lawyer. Don't hold that against me. I'm CEO of the Early Defibrillation Law and Policy Center, and I deal with public policy issues and risk issues surrounding portable defibrillators all around the United States. I had the privilege of working with Representative Hass and Representative Flores on the House side, and appreciated the support of Senator Bates on the Senate side to help craft language in this bill that accomplishes very important public health and public policy goals. Most importantly, from my perspective, having been involved in legal risks surrounding these devices, it modernizes Oregon's AED Good Samaritan law, as well as making the devices available appropriately within health club settings and encouraging schools to deploy the devices. All of these are wonderful public health and public policy goals, and I appreciate, Madam Chair, you bringing this bill up with all the work you have to do, and it passed 60-0 in the House, which really demonstrates the bipartisan nature of this public health effort. I will stop there, given the pressures of your time, and simply make myself available for any technical questions. Thank you.
Any questions?
Madam Chair?
Senator Ringo?
Well, I just want to thank Representative Hass for his courage and leadership in moving this forward.
Thank you.
All right.
Madam Chair, happy birthday.
Thank you.
I remember when I was 29.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think you're 6 months older than I am, so watch it.
Hey.
We're going to close the public hearing on 3482. Let's see that nice note. Okay. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3252. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the bill, Representative Gilman, and did we lose Representative Thatcher?
No.
Somebody scream out the door for her. Just kidding.
Dream.
Just kidding.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 3252 establishes that if the Department of Transportation sets a speed limit in excess of 65 miles per hour on an interstate, the designated speed for certain vehicles like school buses, certain types of trucks, and other automobiles would have to be at least 5 miles per hour lower than the postal speed.
Thank you. Representative Gilman.
Chair Brown, thank you very much. Representative Thatcher went down to check on a bill in another room. Maybe she'll be back. She's got her floor speech for this bill. Your committee assistant did a very good job. It really is very simple. All it does is say, instead of may be more than, it says it must be at least 5 miles. Right now, if the commission were to say out on 84 beyond Pendleton somewhere that cars could go 70 miles an hour, trucks would be able to go 65. With this writing, if the commission decided there should be a 10-mile differential, they'd be able to do that. That's all it's about. I think it's a great bill.
Thank you, Representative Gilman. Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. Doing the dual chamber thing today. Thank you. I'm Kim Thatcher, representative from District 25, Kaiser, St. Paul, and Newburgh. And essentially, this bill is just a cleanup bill from action taken during the last session and allows the large differential, like he was saying, between the large trucks and the passenger trucks. They went out for ODOT went out for public comment during the interim to decide what to do with the 732 miles of interstate highways in Oregon. And ODOT's engineering department came back with a study in August of last year saying they felt it was fine to raise the speed limits on rural interstates to 70, but they didn't think it was wise to raise trucks to 65. So since the two are linked in the current law, the rural interstate speed could not be changed. So This bill would allow that change and allow essentially just give ODOT that flexibility to set traffic speeds at a level they feel is safe for both passenger trucks or passenger cars and then the larger trucks. So that's
all right. Questions? I think it's pretty straightforward. Have any questions? All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate you joining us, Bob Russell and Troy Costales. Can I just put you down on the record in support of the bill? Thank you. Take you guys longer to explain it than it'll take to the word language exists. Okay. Thank you. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3252. Bob Russell and Troy Costales of the Oregon Department of Transportation testified in support of the bill.
ODOT now? Yeah, I guess a new job.
All right.
New job.
Any more legislators?
Excellent.
Representative Gilman, you have another bill? Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Let's go back up to the top of the list.
Happy birthday.
Shut that.
You can't say it on the record.
Yes, I can. Mm-hmm. All right. Let's open House Bill 2800. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2800A modifies the overtime rules for registered nurses, licensed practical nurses, and nursing assistants. And it decreases the number of hours that nurses can work or may be required to work over certain time periods.
Thank you very much. Ms. King, Mr. Bishop. Good afternoon. Welcome. Good to see you. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. Senator Brown, happy birthday.
Thank you.
It's been a long time since I could remember 29, so I'm glad somebody came. Senator Brown and members of the committee.
Happy lobbying there.
just truth-telling. My name is Susan King, representing the Oregon Nurses Association. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on a bill very important to members of my profession, registered nurses. I'm very pleased to be here today with Bruce Bishop, representing the Hospital Association. This bill represents a very significant piece of work that's been done between our two organizations to address the interests that nurses have and hospitals have around how we manage nurse staffing in the facilities across the state. You have my written testimony. Essentially, this bill, by the same number as our bill in 2001, clarifies several issues related to nurse staffing in hospitals. First and foremost is it clarifies and updates the language around mandatory overtime. We have changed some of the provisions for the number of hours which nurses can be required to work in a hospital in this state. I want to be clear that nothing in the provisions of this bill have any impact on voluntary overtime, that is, the overtime that nurses choose to work to make up for particular situations that occur in hospitals. Since 2001, there has been a significant body of research generated about errors and the impact of fatigue on patient care, quality of patient care, most specifically errors, with the preponderance of research showing that errors more frequently occur and begin to increase in number at about 11 to 12 hours in a given shift. Consequently, we have changed our language from the existing statute or to a 12-hour in 24-hour period, leaving some flexibility for hospitals in the event that certain events occur, such as a last-minute notice of a vacancy, epidemic illness, et cetera. So, again, there is flexibility, even though we've imposed some more clear mandatory overtime limits in the bill. The second major area that this bill addresses is how a staffing plan within a facility is developed. What we are proposing is that each facility in the state would be required to have a committee dedicated to developing the staffing plan, and that committee would be based on at least 50% management staff, 50% direct care clinical staff. To get the perspectives of both. The committee would be charged with making the final decision about the staffing plan for that hospital, and the staffing plan is based on patient need at its core. My organization at this time does not support a mandated ratio as other states have tried. We have instead, with the agreement of OAHHS, imported language that says specialty standards, where they exist, would be used as another part of the basis of the staffing plan for hospitals across the state. So we think this is a significant movement on improving nurse staffing in hospitals, which in turn will improve the quality of care and in turn be a benefit not only to the patients but the facilities in which they receive their care. I thank you for the opportunity to speak to you about this important bill and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Bishop.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, appearing on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems in support of the engrossed version of House Bill 2800. As Ms. King testified, we did work collaboratively with the Oregon Nurses Association and the Speaker's Office on this bill and reached agreement on the provisions that were acceptable to all of the parties. We do support that version of the bill. There are amendments that may be presented to you that address other issues than are within the engrossed version of the bill. We're not necessarily opposing those amendments, but we do not support them. And we do not think that they're necessary to the bill or were part of the negotiation that we had in the Speaker's office about this legislation.
Mr. Bishop, I'm sorry, they were not part of the...
No, when we talked in the Speaker's office, we agreed on the engrossed version of the bill without the amendments that may be presented to you later. So we do support the engrossed version of House Bill 2800 and have appreciated the opportunity to work with the Oregon Nurses Association and the Speaker.
Great. Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. Anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 2800? Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2800. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3197. Anybody wishing to testify on House Bill 3197? I understand that Representative Burke, come on up.
3197.
Hello, how are you?
Good afternoon. Chair Brown.
Yeah, just a second. I'm going to have Ms. Harris tell us a little bit about the bill. I forgot that part.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Committee. House Bill 3197A requires the Department of Transportation to transfer certain driver license information regarding anatomical gift donors. As I understand it, the bill was drafted in anticipation of the development of a statewide registry of organ donors.
Thank you. Ms. Hunt, welcome.
Yes. Good afternoon. Thank you. I'm here representing Oregon Donor Program, as well as with me today are the directors of the Lions Eye Bank of Oregon, as well as Community Tissue Services. We are in support of House Bill 3197, particularly because it is in the best benefit and interest of those who are waiting for transplants. Very simply and quickly, this bill will allow DMV to transfer the necessary data to establish a statewide registry, which will improve the access to those agencies when identifying donors. It also aligns our state law with certain Medicare regulations that were enacted and addresses those situations, as well as clarifies the role of emergency medical personnel at the scene of an accident and what to do with a D on your driver's license. We appreciate you hearing this and hope for your support.
Thank you. And Representative Berger couldn't be here, so she also would be here otherwise, testify and support the bill. Questions for Ms. Hunt? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate you joining us. Anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 3197? Close the public hearing. Let's move to House Bill 3223. I'm just going to go right down the order. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3223. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us a little bit about the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 3223 allows major political parties to determine the date for organizational meetings of the County Central Committee and State Central Committee. And Oregon statutes define County Central Committees as basically the precinct committee persons that were elected from that county. They also serve as the Central Committee of a political party.
All right. I have Representative McPherson and Representative P. Smith. Not seeing anybody around. Anybody wishing to testify on this bill? All right. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3223. Let's move on to 3252. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about 3252?
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 3252A establishes that...
We did this one already. Okay.
We can do it again if you want.
No, that's okay. Oh, that's that one? No. We're not going to close the public hearing on that one. All right. House Bill 3257.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 3257A authorizes the governor to appoint a pastor, present employee, or commissioner of a court to the Oregon Board of Maritime Pilots.
Thank you. Mr. Egan, Mr. Fiskem.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. For the record, Pat Egan with the Port of Portland. This is a bill that us and the Oregon Ports Group introduced and has passed the House unanimously. The bill does one simple change to the Board of Maritime Pilots. It's a 9-member board now.
Just so everybody knows, most of the bills we're hearing at this point have passed the House unanimously.
I understand.
So.
I understand. It fits right into that category, Madam Chair.
Okay.
The board right now is made up of 9 individuals, 3 pilots, 3 industry representatives, which are the steamship operators, and 3 public members. The 3 public members are prohibited from having any financial interest in marine commerce, period, pilotage rates. What this bill does is to allow a port, any port, to be represented by an employee, current or past, or a commissioner, current or past, as an individual member, one of the 9 slots on the Board of Maritime Pilots, one of the 3 industry slots. Marine commerce, obviously, very important to us, very important to the state, and we've got, I think, buy-in from all of the various stakeholders on this at this point. Thank you.
Mr. Fiskem.
Madam Chair, for the record, Dave Fiskem. I'm here representing the Columbia River Pilots, the pilots who take ships up and down river between Astoria and Portland. I'm tempted to utter one-word testimony, which is ditto. It would fair of me to just emphasize that in the consideration of this bill this session, all parties have worked together to craft this bill, which comes to you with no opposition to my knowledge. Thank you.
Great. Any questions for these 2? Senator Atkinson.
Why do we need a law to do this?
Madam Chair, Senator Atkinson, the statute right now dictates that you've got the 3 three separate slots among the nine members.
Yeah.
That provision that says you cannot have any monetary direct monetary interest in marine commerce has been interpreted to mean that a port employee, a port commissioner, current or past, cannot serve until a five-year period has lapsed. At that point, then, someone with that kind of knowledge or expertise could be appointed to the Board of Maritime Pilots. We have a very keen interest in the rate-setting process here. It's a competitive element, us particularly versus the Puget Sound, and how pilots are compensated, how they're trained is of great interest to us. We are a participant in the rate-making process from the outside. We'd like a seat at the table along with the other interests.
Any other questions?
Thank you. Thank you for your time.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 3257. All right, let's open a public hearing. We didn't do House Bill 3272. We haven't done that one yet. House Bill 3272, Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 3272A increases the threshold of the project size used for determining when local public contracting agencies are required to use certain selection criteria for architectural, engineering, or land surveying services. This is House Bill 3272A.
All right. Mr. Koba, Ms. Roberts.
Good afternoon, Chair Brown and members of the committee. I'm Marshall Koba, representing the American Council of Engineering Companies of Oregon this afternoon in support of House Bill 3272A. We have passed out of the House, of course, following negotiations with many of our local government friends on this issue. Included in those negotiations were the League of Oregon Cities, the counties, the ports, school boards, special districts, community colleges, and others. House Bill 3272A will change the requirement for qualification-based selection, which is the procurement method that government uses when hiring an engineer, an architect, or a land surveyor. Current law requires QBS to be used when a project is at least $400,000 and 35% of the funds come from state government. This bill will require then that the threshold amount will be increased to $900,000, but the state funding participation will drop from 30% to 10%. In addition, this bill removes a sunset that was part of the legislation from 2001. The sunset was July 1 of 2008. I've handed out a great deal of background information. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Questions for this group? Ms. Robert.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, happy birthday, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
My name is Cindy Robert, and I'm proud to represent the American Institute of Architects. I come here today to ask you to support this bill, but I just want to add that I asked Marshall not to read that statement, and number two, that I'm a little nervous about the bill only because we all, the cities, the counties, the engineers, and architects, we all called our clients and said, yay, we won, which makes me a little nervous, but it's a good bill.
Okay. All right. You're off the hook from questions. All right. Thank you very much. Ms. Munson, Ms. Rich.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Christy Munson, representing League of Oregon Cities, just here to let you know that this was a collaborative process. We believe we won, but but here to answer any questions.
Ms. Rich.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Amanda Rich. I'm representing Special Districts Association of Oregon, and we did win, and we feel really good about this bill.
John Olson, Association of Oregon Counties. I'm not going there.
All right. Any questions for this group? Thank you very much. Anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 3272?
American Council of Who?
We're going to close the public hearing.
Okay.
All right, we're going to open the public hearing on House Bill 3301.
Thank you, Ms. Harris. House Bill 3301B authorizes the formation of county service districts with overlapping jurisdiction if the districts are authorized to provide different services. And we have a dash 3 amendment. Maybe someone will talk to us about that.
Mr. Van Vactor.
Yes. Good afternoon.
Chair Brown, members of the committee. My name is Bill Van Vactor. I currently serve as the Lane County Administrator. You're going to be having distributed to you a letter that kind of explains the background locally of why we are making this request, but I really think I can kind of cut to the chase in terms of not going through the points of that letter and simply point out that our county council is concerned that there is a provision of Oregon law that prohibits what are called ORS 451 county service districts from being in the same territory, and we are requesting a change in Oregon law so that so long as those districts provide different services, there is no conflict, and we can proceed, should we work it out locally with our partners, to the Boundary Commission and then on to the voters, potentially in November of 2006. So we view it as a minor clarification of law, but very important clarification, because we do have a Boundary Commission, and as in the past, they obviously would need to be comfortable with that statute. They're not conflicting with that statute. So, okay. If you have any questions.
Are the amendments yours?
No, we have not. We are not proposing any amendments.
All right. I'm sorry, you're...
We are not proposing any amendments from 3301B.
All right. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, who's the owner of the B3 amendments? Fess up. It's Mr. I think it's Representative Holby. So. Okay. Okay. All right. Anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 3301?
Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo?
I just had a question that maybe I should have asked.
Yeah, that
would have
been
there.
Good.
Sorry.
Senator Ringo, but I'm sure Mr. Van Vactor would be willing to come back up.
Thank you. I just want to, I'm looking in here for the definition of county service districts, and I'm sure it's here. What is it?
Generally, it's a provision under Oregon law where there's a list like special districts of services. The differences between a county service district and what we're familiar with, which are special districts like fire districts,
uh-huh.
is that the Board of County Commissioners serve as the governing body of a ORS 451 district. So it, in essence, is really just kind of a paper district that is, in our view, a financing vehicle, because under ballot measures 5, 47, and 50 now, the county's tax rate is capped. And so if we can form a district, it's a way to get more money. In our particular case, as we identify in the letter, our hope is to do so for public safety services.
And these districts, thank you, these districts could perform the gamut of whether it's sewer, water, fire, police.
Yeah, there's a whole list of services. It's very lengthy in the statute, two different sections.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, last chance, House Bill 3301. Okay, let's close that public hearing. All right, let's open a public hearing on 3318.
Thanks, Madam Chair of Committee. House Bill 3318 increases the amount that employers can pay for medical services in connection with a non-disabling claim, and it increases that figure from $500 to $1,500.
Mr. Wilson, Ms. Adamson.
Thank you, Chair Brown and members of the committee. For the record, J.L. Wilson representing NFIB and also a co-chair of the Management Labor Advisory Committee. The upshot of House Bill 3318 is basically that for any non-disabling claim that costs $1,500 or less to treat, this bill says an employer can pay out of pocket to treat that non-disabling claim and have it not count against their experience rating when it comes to their workers' comp premiums. And for this, we're talking about sprains, scrapes, cuts that may require stitches, those types of things, relatively minor. The amount set in the Mahonia Hall agreements was $500. That was 15 years ago. We're suggesting upping that amount to $1,500, consistent with price increases over the time. It was agreed upon unanimously by MLAC.
Thank you. Ms. Adamson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Harris Adamson with Associated General Contractors, and we would just echo what Mr. Wilson just said. This would be a help to employers and maintain the high quality of care for workers.
Thank you. Mr. Wilson, in your price index and conversations with MLAC, did you all have any conversations about
you know, doing this on a, taking a look at this not on an annual basis, but a decade basis or whatever? Are we just going to have to come back every 15 years and change the law?
Thank you, Chair Brown. You know, I don't think any of us had thought to do it. This was at the request of one particular employer, and when we saw the bill, we obviously embraced it. I would be more than happy to take a look at doing this on an adjusted basis annually so you never have to see it again.
Okay. Any other questions?
Would we have time to do that?
I don't know. I think we have plenty of time.
Say it ain't so.
All right. Thank you very much. Anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 3318? I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3318. Got more noise to start. What's up? 3329? Open public hearing on House Bill 3329. Ms. Harris.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Committee. We actually had a public hearing on this bill a couple of weeks ago. The specific date escapes me, but perhaps the proponents can remind us when that was. So we're here now for the purpose of a work session. There were some amendments that weren't done at the time, but I understand we have them all set to go.
Thank you. Mr. Taylor, why don't you walk us through the amendments?
Chair Brown, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Martin Taylor with the Oregon Nurses Association, and I would love to walk you through the 3329A5 amendments, only I can't even pretend to understand them. I am not an expert.
Could you tell us the purpose of the amendments?
The purpose of the amendments is that the bill wasn't correctly hooked into the enforcement language in the insurance division. I facilitated the state insurance division helping me get the language right to hook it into the insurance codes, and there are folks here that could represent how that works, but I'm not one of those.
Okay. That's good. That you admitted that. You admitted that.
Happy birthday.
Yes. Questions for Mr. Taylor? Anybody else wishing to testify in these amendments? I think we got the gist of them. Thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3329. I'm just going to move all the bills at the same time. So let's continue down since we're so successful on our public hearing so far. Yes. Okay, we're back to 3443. Coming back to House Bill 3443, we heard this earlier. Ms. Lowe, why don't you just come on up and try to remember who else signed up. Holy smokes. Ah, Ms. Wayne. Good afternoon. Good to see you.
Hi, Chair Brown. And members of the committee, I'm pleased you're sharing your birthday with all of us, and I hope you...
There is no place I'd rather be.
You don't lie well.
I'm not so sure.
I'm Ellen Lowe, and I'm here on behalf of United Way of the Columbia Willamette. And you have before you a bill that will allow Oregon to become linked with the 211 initiative. The Federal Communication Commission in 2000 approved the number for information on health and human services and also services after an emergency, but it's up to the state to make sure that something happens within the state. I won't take your time with the history of all the involvement that's gone into putting Oregon 211 together, but I do want to say that it has been an effort that has involved all all the stakeholders, including the communication folks, as well as all the various agencies that might have some interest in this. And we went from examining turf initially to a very collaborative process. And I also want to give credit to United Way, because they, rather than coming to this body when 211 was first adopted and for a pilot project and asking you for resources, United Way has put in almost $800,000 into this effort and leveraged over $400,000 in grants, so that there really could be something that was operative. And I would now, the person who assisted United Way in providing technical information is Lisa Lempt, and so perhaps she can describe to you what is in place in the Tri-County area and hopefully will be statewide someday.
Great.
Thanks, Chair Brown.
Welcome.
Members of the committee, my name is Lisa Lent, and I'm with 211 Info, which is the local call center serving a four-county area located in Portland, Oregon. The other fourth county is across the river in Washington State, and we've really tried to become a bit of a national model in terms of doing some cross-border work with 211. So in short, I wanted to, I joke that my son often says, why did it take you so long to get 211 ringing when our home digit has 10 digits and it rings quite nicely, and it took you 2 years to get 211 ringing? But it has truly been a complicated collaborative process, and it has been United Way that's brought it to this state that we're at right now. Currently, over 40% of the United States has access to 211, and that looks very different in different communities, from a statewide call center in Connecticut to a regional call center in Atlanta. One of the reasons for this particular piece of legislation is that there is federal legislation, aptly named Senate Bill 211, in Congress right now, and that would actually authorize funds to start up and operate 211s across the country. And at this moment, we need a placeholder at this state so that when those funds, knock on something, real wood, come, that we have a place for those to go, and that we can use those dollars to leverage what we already have in the state and truly deliver a statewide 211 call center. And just to give you a bit of a snapshot of what people are calling for, last year there were over 100,000 phone calls in the Tri-County area, with the majority of those being for utility assistance, rent assistance, and emergency food. So it's truly basic needs that people are calling for, and that we're providing connections for people.
Madam Chair, I neglected to mention that Doug Wilson, the legislative fiscal analyst, said, Ellen, you might really retire, and we might not be able to trust your successor to make sure that this doesn't cost the Office of Emergency Management any money this next biennium. So you do have an amendment before you, which I hope that you will adopt.
That's right. That's to make sure it doesn't cost any money.
Yes.
For the dash race. Okay. Thank you. Any questions for these two? Thank you for your hard work on this very important issue, and it's good to have you in the Capitol again today.
Thank you.
All right, Jim Long.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Jim Long, and I totally support this House bill. It already has helped a lot of people and will continue to help a lot of people. As you know, or maybe you don't know, but Oregon 211 is participating in the Blue Pages rulemaking proceeding, and they are very helpful, and it provides a wonderful opportunity where I think there might be a link that could happen. I don't know. I'm not the legal expert. You folks are. But Oregon 211 has... they have offered to discuss with the phone companies updating the classified Blue Pages listings. This is something the phone company has been squawking about for years, as they have a tough time updating them. And the Oregon 211 will have the centralized database, and they could easily update in a system the name, phone number, and address of these agencies. I think it will improve connections a lot of ways. I totally support the 211, but I think they're, you know, 211 will get a prominent listing in the blue pages, and on the other hand, 211 should have a designated role in updating the blue pages. And maybe that's something that the Public Utility Commission will come up with, but it's my belief that there's a real way to have cost effectiveness and efficiency by setting up a system like that. And that's my testimony.
Thank you. Mr. Long, have you talked with the proponents of the bill about your proposal?
Have I talked with?
The proponents, Ms. Wendt, Ms. Lowe, about your proposal. Have you tried to work anything out to address?
Well, we see them as kind of separate things, but if you see a way that they should be merged, that might be a good model. It could be a good thing. At this point, the relating clauses are different. I think that there's two things there, and if they can, you know, if there's a link that can be done, that's fine. If there's ways that they, you know, one gets amended, the other gets amended, they both get amended, doesn't matter to me. I just would like for you folks to consider what makes the most sense for Oregonians.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Long? Thank you for your hard work. All right. Anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 3443? I close the public hearing on House Bill 3443. Pretty straightforward. I open a public hearing on House Bill 3468. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the bill?
Thanks, Madam Chair. Committee, House Bill 3468 carves out an exception to our Unlawful Trade Practices Act for acts of a telephone directory publisher that involve false or misleading disseminations when those disseminations are the result of basically accidents or carelessness.
Mr. Wolf, Mr. Neely, why don't you come on up? Of course, in so doing, you'll have to explain why you got that fabulous black eye.
No, I'll let Mr. Wolf go first.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Brant Wolf, representing the Oregon Telecommunications Association. This is our bill. And as indicated, this bill would merely place into the statute publishers of telephone directories in that section of the statute that provides some exemptions from the Unfair Trade Practices Act that are currently enjoyed by other publishers of media like newspapers and television, things of that nature. It's not meant to excuse or exempt anyone from liability if they knowingly place false or deceptive advertisements, and I don't think the bill does that. If you look on page 2 of testimony, you'll see the legal case that kind of prompted us to bring this bill. I need to tell you that on the House side, there was one no vote. Representative Greenlick, I followed up and had a conversation with him, and he is okay with the bill now, and he said I could reference the conversation. It's come to my attention that the Department of Justice does have some concerns with the bill, although they are not opposing it. I think our testimony addresses their concerns, I hope, and I can certainly answer any questions if they come up from Mr. Neely's conversation. And that is the long and short of the bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Wolf. Mr. Neely, I'm sorry, and I didn't see your neutral. I thought you guys were on this together. So.
No, but I would hate to interrupt the flow and have someone actually come up and oppose the bill. For the record, Kevin Neely, Attorney General Hardy Meyer's office.
It happened.
And, again, I'm here on House Bill 3468, and rest assured, Senator Brown, there are many people that are taking credit for this black eye. The Department of Justice does have some concerns. We are neutral, as Mr. Wolf said, on this bill. We have spoken to him about some of our concerns. Our principal concern stems from the fact that what's currently excluded from UTPA protection are things like newspapers, periodicals, radio, television stations, those sorts of things. I think we can all agree that when we pick up the newspaper, our goal is to read the news. When we pick up a telephone directory, our goal is to actually find some services that hopefully will lead us into being consumers of those businesses. There is a difference between those types of businesses. But again, we recognize that there are some concerns and they'd like their exclusion. In that spirit, we would suggest that, one, because of the infrequency with which telephone directories are published, we are a little bit worried that if a problem does exist in, for example, the Yellow Pages, it's going to be a year that consumers are reading that book and may be directed to folks that are, in fact, misrepresenting the nature of their business, whether or not they're a licensed contractor or a licensed caregiver of some sort in that publication, and there's no opportunity for change within that year.
But again, we're willing to overlook that for the time being and hope, in fact, that these telephone publishers or directory publishers will be very good stewards of the information that they're passing forward. In that spirit, we do think that the best solution here is a business practice that could occur with those telephone directory companies, and that is simply at the front end to ask the advertisers to affirm positively that they're not lying in their advertisement, that they are, in fact, licensed and properly licensed if they need to be licensed, and that the terms under which they're advertising are accurate. We think that has a couple of benefits. One, obviously, it gives consumers information that they need and assurances that the information is accurate. And two, we believe that it provides the liability shield that these companies are seeking right now that they're going to get in this bill. So in that spirit, we're neutral on the bill. However, if we find that we get a blossoming of consumer complaints on this area, I suspect that we will be back in front of you in 2007 seeking to codify that these companies need to proactively seek affirmation ahead of the advertising that the advertiser is, in fact, presenting reliable and accurate information to the directory. With that, I will end my testimony and field any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Neely. So it's basically like the voters' pamphlets that candidates swear ahead of time that the information is accurate and truthful to the best of their knowledge, and therefore the Secretary of State is not responsible for the information. Okay. Senator Farrielli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If a person's willing to lie to the general public, why wouldn't they be willing to lie to the publisher?
Chair Brown, Senator Farrelly, they certainly are willing to lie. Again, what this would do is, in theory, absolve the publisher of a little bit of potential liability they might have. And I think also, if a consumer wanted to go out and take action against that individual, they'd probably have a little bit easier case to plead if, in fact, they had a document there that said that this was accurate and it clearly wasn't. So, again, I think it's a benefit in that way. And it may well just turn back one of those wily businesses that wants to lie, and they might see that and say, geez, I'm not going to sign this affidavit saying this is all accurate.
Okay. Other questions? All right. Thank you. Anybody else wishing to testify? I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3468. Okay. We're moving in. Well, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3479. Ms. Harris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We have a dash one amendment for this bill, and the bill requires that any entity that acquires all or a portion of PGE would assume proportionate shares of obligations and liabilities related to the construction and operation of the Trojan nuclear plant.
All right, Ms. Henry.
Madam Chair, members
Ms.
of the
Henry.
Committee.
Yes. Go ahead.
Oh. Am I missing something?
No, just go. We're talking about the last bill. I'm
okay.
Arguing.
Good, 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 good. Libby Henry representing the Eugene Water and Electric Board. The purpose of this bill is to provide assurance that any new purchaser of PGE or any purchasers of PGE will assume their share of the liabilities and assets associated with the Trojan nuclear waste storage facility, we're calling it now. It was a power plant. It is no longer. Trojan is owned by three owners, PGE at 67.5%, EWEB 30%, and PacifiCorp 2.5%. Since the PUC denied Texas Pacific Group's petition to purchase PGE, the future care and financing of nuclear storage at Trojan has become uncertain. Currently, PGE is a managing partner. They're responsible for maintaining the facility and managing safe storage of nuclear waste. A new facility is scheduled to be available to move this nuclear waste to by 2018, but we're not counting on that becoming available. In this case, Trojan would become a permanent waste storage facility, and responsibility for the facility, including costs, would remain with the three owners. If Trojan becomes a permanent waste storage site, we anticipate the Nuclear Regulatory Commission will tighten regulations for nuclear storage. This too will add to the expense of maintaining the facility. If PGE is sold, both the license and the site certificate would be transferred to the new owner. The question is what criteria the Nuclear Regulatory Commission would apply to allow for the transfer of the license. And the same question pertains to the transfer of the site certificate to the Oregon Facility Siting Council. The site certificate is a letter from then-Governor Tom McCall that says, welcome. That's it. So not a lot in it. Right. Back in those days, those kind of things. In addition to assuming the liabilities, the new owner would also assume PGE's share of the decommissioning fund, which is about at $100 million. In the event the fund gets depleted because of some unknown hazardous event happens or other circumstance, then this new entity could raise rates to cover the costs. These amendments you have before you are going into in-depth of the third page, detailed proposed amendments. They've been worked out by PGE, City of Portland. The language has been shared with all the customer groups of PGE, the PUC, Bonneville, Oregon Department of Energy. I know of no problem with it. The amendments, we move from a definition of assets and taking over part of PGE to the allocated territory. It makes more sense to speak the actual territory where the distribution is than the assets that they own. And then I think probably two other things. City of Portland, they want to be sure that if monies were due in the decommissioning account, it wouldn't be due all at once, so we have the term when due. And then finally, there's a situation where you might have PGE with contiguous service territory to, say, Canby Utility Board. And in the normal course of business, there might be an annexation where the city of Canby would take on a small share of the PGE service territory. It wasn't our intent to have Trojan liabilities and assets transferred with that. So we come in with some percentages that we came to agreement with PGE that would be reasonable in looking at a small portion of the territory moving over to a utility that shares the boundary. I think that's it. I went as fast as I could.
Senator Shields.
I think you went too fast for me.
Does okay.
To use your example, does that mean that Canby, for instance, would end up with a share?
No, that means they would not end up with a share. Right, right.
I'm getting ahead of you.
Right. At the end of the bill, we go to 1% service area and then one-tenth of 1% of the population. So that gets it down to about 1,600 customers. So there are not annexations or business transactions that exceed that. We talked to Candy about this and to PGE, and so we didn't want that obligation to follow with that kind of business activity. That's why we amended the bill. Yeah, that's right.
Senator Farrioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to kind of drill into this a little bit because I think there's a fascinating issue here that hasn't really been very well explored in the equation where the City of Portland, for instance, might acquire PGE.
Mm-hmm.
Currently, Madam Chair, as I understand it, the shareholders of Portland General Electric are wholly and completely responsible for the costs associated with decommissioning and maintaining Trojan. Is that correct?
Yes, the plant is no longer used and useful.
Right. So the core has been removed, but all the fissionable materials are still stored on that site.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to be stored on that site indefinitely. Is that not true?
We don't know. We just don't know. That's one of the reasons for the bill.
Okay. Well, there has been no national repository approved for the storage of nuclear waste.
Mm-hmm.
And until a national repository is approved, those fissionable materials are sequestered at the site.
Mm-hmm.
And has anybody, do you happen to know what the half-life is of the fissionable materials that are there?
No, but Senator, pardon me, I'm sure Senator Farrioli, you're going to tell me.
I am. It's 250,000 years for the first half-life, and it takes 20 half-lives to take fissionable material to inert so it's not harmful to human health. And I just was curious to know if the City of Portland purchases PG&E, what share of the liability for the Trojan Nuclear Waste Repository do they purchase?
It would be the same representing the proportionate share now, which is 67.5%. The thing is, though, the decommissioning fund was built up during a time, part of the time when the plant was used and useful, so there were rates coming from customers of PG that actually did benefit from the production of that power at the time. So it's not totally a dark hole for those customers to take that on.
So there's a reserve.
Right, right. Yeah. And it wouldn't matter who purchased PG. The only thing that would be an exception to this is if the stock were distributed, in which case there'd be no change of administration, and this issue would go away.
Okay, Madam Chair, I think the important distinction here to make is that if the people of Portland buy PG&E, there'll be another obligor there'll be another group of people that are obligated to pay. If the ratepayers fail in their duty to pay, who pays?
Well, the rates are, can be increased to make sure they do pay, so that's a fail-safe in this bill.
Yeah, but won't the
PGE, not PG&E.
Yep.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. But isn't it also true that if the City of Portland purchased PGE, they would be, in fact, obligating the taxpayers if there be any default by the company? Wouldn't the City of Portland own...
Yeah,
PGE.
City of Portland probably be financially responsible.
Yeah, so I just wanted to make sure that people know that the City of Portland is contemplating purchasing a nuclear waste repository with a possible half-life future of many hundreds of thousands of years. If there's no approval of a national nuclear waste repository, which, from my experience, Madam Chair, on the Hanford Nuclear Waste Board, Oregon Hanford Nuclear Waste Board, is a long shot, very almost unlikely to happen. Folks in Nevada don't want their state to become a nuclear waste dump. But I just don't believe that the people in Portland have adequately had a discussion about what it's going to be like for them to be the owner and the responsible obligor for operating a nuclear waste repository.
Madam Chair, the talk right now is that Portland will transfer both the bonds and the responsibility for the utility over to a regional authority. That's what we're negotiating now, in which case two-thirds of that total service territory will be borne by six other counties and 52 other cities, and so that will be shared. I guess my point is that we do need to take care of the site.
And one last observation.
Senator Farrioli.
Madam Chair, I understand the wisdom of trying to spread that liability over the largest possible pool of people, but right now a private sector group of stockholders is wholly responsible. And under the purchase plan by the city, it's going to be taxpayers in six jurisdictions and 52 cities that will be responsible.
Madam Chair,
I'm the senator here.
I feel I need to respond to that. The Federal Nuclear Regulatory Commission will have something to say about this, the transfer of the license, and we're not sure what they'll decide. So to conclude who's wholly responsible at this point in time is probably premature. This bill is a fail-safe for us because we're not sure exactly what they'll decide. I doubt that they'll stick the citizens of Eugene with the total cost of the Trojan nuclear facility, but we want to make sure that wouldn't happen.
Thank you, Ms. Henry.
Madam Chair,
Senator Farrioli, we would love to have you come to Portland and have a conversation with the folks that live in Portland about your concerns.
Yes, Madam Chair. I would certainly support the bill. I just hope the citizens of Portland understand what comes along with, you know, the great potential of owning a piece of PGE. It also comes with a huge and lasting liability. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Shields.
I just wanted to thank the good senator for exposing this Trojan horse.
More like an exploding cigar, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Senator Farrioli and the citizens of Portland are extremely grateful that you're concerned for their welfare.
I'm a state senator, Madam Chair.
Yes, good. So let's fund our schools then. Okay, Senator Ringo. Senator Ringo.
Wow, this conversation is going crazy.
I had too much ice cream.
I want to understand this a little bit better. You're saying that right now it's not clear who owns the liability and this is the fail-safe?
No. This is the fail-safe is, let's say there were an earthquake, all right, and the cost of storing that those spent fuel rods and everything or protecting them went up a lot. And we get to 2025 or 2040 and the decommissioning fund is depleted. Then the question is, how do we raise funds to maintain that site, assuming that spent fuel will remain there because we don't have a place to move it to. So we're just looking for a way for this new owner to share the responsibility with us, the 30% owner, right, to make sure that it's cared for.
Thank you. Just a follow-up, Madam Chair. But
Senator Ringo.
But the current owner of PGE are the creditors, correct? I know this is kind of an odd situation, but generally when you purchase a corporation, you purchase its assets and its liabilities. Mm-hmm. I mean, you get both of them together.
Yes, that's correct.
And that's why I wonder, when they purchased shares of PGE or acquired shares of PGE, didn't they also acquire shares of the yes. of obligation? And that obligation might include cleaning up the mess if it's still there after the fund runs out.
Yes. Madam Chair, you've heard conversations about only purchasing the assets and talk like
yeah.
that. Well, it's not likely that'll happen, okay. but we hear that too, so...
But it's your understanding that right now, that nobody owns PGE assets but do not own liabilities. They,
yeah.
They've come together. Okay. Okay. Madam Chair, I'm happy to vote for this bill. I find it curious, but I'm happy to support it.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Henry. That was a very interesting conversation.
Great.
All right. Anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 3479?
Can this Henry come back?
I'm sure if you want her to come back, you can get her to come back. All right. Let's open a public hearing on HJM 35. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the bill? Mr. Dewey, are you folks here on this HJM 35? Just guessing. Okay, Mr. Schellenberg. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. HJM 35 urges Congress to pass legislation declaring that farm trucks are operating in intrastate commerce when they're within 150 miles from a home farm. And I think the significance of the intrastate commerce wording is that it would allow the state to regulate a field of truck safety that is currently subject to federal oversight.
Mr. Schellenberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Don Schellenberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. Not requesters of the bill, but here certainly in support of the bill. Unfortunately, Tammy Denny, Executive Director of the Oregon Wheat League, had to be in Washington, D.C., and is not able to testify today, but I would like to offer our support. Interstate and intrastate gets kind of confusing. Whenever you say intrastate transportation, you would think that that's just within the state, and if you say interstate, it means through various states that you'd be transporting product. But in this case, the federal government doesn't operate logically, which I guess maybe not unusual. But in this case, they look at the product and they say, well, if that product that you're transporting is going to ever end up in interstate commerce, if it's ever going to leave the state, then you, Mr. Truck driver, farmer, are in interstate commerce, and therefore you are subject to inspections just the same as all long-haul truckers are subject to. Well, that makes it very difficult for us, of course. And so what the bill does is give the sense of the Oregon legislature to Congress, asking them to change that so that if you are within 150 miles of your farm, you are considered to be an intrastate transportation and not subject to these unnecessary inspections. So we ask the chair and the committee for support for moving this HJM 35.
Thank you very much. And Ms. Denny sent me a letter saying she couldn't be here, so we really appreciate her conscientiousness. Any questions for Mr. Schellenberg? Anybody else wishing to testify on HJM 35? Let's close the public hearing. Let's open the public hearing on Senate Bill 1080. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the bill? Ms. Shibley, why don't you come on up?
Committee. Senate Bill 1080 modifies the statutes governing the Department of Human Services surveys of drinking water sources. Specifically, the bill requires that laboratories conducting analyses of drinking water samples have to receive validated results directly if the analysis shows a certain amount of contamination.
All right. Thank you. Good afternoon and welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Gail Shibley. I'm the administrator of the Office of Public Health Systems in the Oregon Department of Human Services. Senate Bill 1080, in the department's opinion, is a real solution and an opportunity to improve public health and protect the state's drinking water. The current statute requires that all lab test results be sent to the water suppliers, although the suppliers can also authorize their laboratory to report results to the department. And we get a lot of those results directly electronically. 1080 modifies the statute by directing laboratories to send DHS copies of results from a small but critical percentage of those tests, validated tests that identify drinking water as not meeting federal drinking water standards. The National State Auditors Association conducted a joint audit with which Oregon participated a couple years ago and identified a variety of recommendations for improving the state's oversight to assure safe drinking water. We are diligently working, either have completed or close to completing all of our recommendations. They had one recommendation to the legislature, and it was to amend this statute to require laboratories to report public drinking water test results directly to both the division and the water system operators. They made that recommendation, as identified in the report, by calling out the fact that the state public health authority is not receiving test results that indicate that there's a public health problem. And we want to close that loophole. We think the language in the Senate bill does that in a narrow but very on-point way. We think that this can address the findings, what the audit report called a critical weakness, in a very simple and direct way, and we can solve the problem once and for all. It's been around for a long time, keeps coming up session over after session after session. And we think this is a solution that fits the problem, and we certainly support this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Tiffany.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Willie Tiffany with the League of Oregon Cities. We also support this bill. This bill originally appeared as Senate Bill 347. We were originally opposed to Senate Bill 347. And as such, created a work group involving large and small municipalities, the laboratories, and the state. We came up with amendments to Senate Bill 347, which we could agree to, and those are incorporated in Senate Bill 1080. Basically, the provisions that were changed were referring specifically to validated lab results. That's a large issue for municipal suppliers, and that is a term of art under the federally certified requirements we now have here in the state of Oregon. We also limited the results to compliance-based results, so we're really targeting, what is in the best public interest in terms of knowledge of those water reports. And then lastly, we also I think actually those were the two issues that we agreed upon. It's been some time since we looked at this bill, but we are supportive of 1080, and thank you very much. We'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Ms. Rich.
Madam Chair, member of the committee, I'm Amanda Rich, representing the Special Districts Association of Oregon and the Oregon Association of Water Utilities. We participated in the work group that Mr. Tiffany referred to, and echo both his and Ms. Shibley's testimony that this is a solution to a problem that's been around for quite a while, frankly, since the Secretary of State's audit, and we think this is a good compromise, and it meets the needs of all the water utilities that I represent. So I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
For the record, Ms. Shibley, does the bill remove any responsibility from the water supplier to report all required test results to the department?
Madam Chair, no, it does not.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate you joining us. Ms. Myers.
Uh-oh.
I'm going to be very short.
Okay.
Madam Chair and Committee, my name is Beth Myers, and I've owned and operated an environmental accredited testing lab since about 1980. And it seems to us that I was on the committee that participated in this work group, and we just feel like the bill, it's like putting a bull in a five-acre plot and putting about a five-foot fence around him. It doesn't solve any problems. It brings more issues up. The health division doesn't have enough staff. I'm amazed they can get enough done with what they do have. We have
do have serious problems in the water systems. And what I brought up here to show you is that these are the lists of the public water supplies off the inventory Friday. There are 887 public water supplies community. That means more than 15 connections in Oregon. And 191 of them do not have compliant operator staff. That's the problem right there. We get more and more people, as my testimony I submitted is, who ask the strangest questions, who are water system operators. These systems, and I'll leave you these if you want to look through them, and I've highlighted them on this. I'll leave this for you. That's 22% of the public water suppliers that don't have adequate operator certification. So I think we would be better off putting our resources there. They ask us when they should test, where they should test. They ask us all kinds of things that we shouldn't be asked. We have water operators who used to be, you know, we used to be an agrarian society, and men would know how to fix pumps and work on pipe and things like that. Now our water operators are bankers who do this in their off hours. And I think we do have a serious problem, but I don't think it lies in the reporting, and I don't think we will benefit from this automatic reporting because it misses the point of protecting the water suppliers. I would rather see us really deal with the water operators. I have several situations in my office that I'm going to be talking to Dave about afterward.
Thank you. Senator Lingo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a little bit of background. We had this identical concept in my committee, and we had hearings, and Ms. Myers testified on that bill. I think the bill makes complete sense because, I mean, you said it's the bill is designed to protect the water suppliers. I don't think that's right at all. I think it's designed to protect the public. It's designed to protect the public from, for example, E. coli in the water supply, and because of a bureaucratic foul-up, the message never gets from A to B to C, and somebody's health is put at risk.
Well, I have a serious issue with the Secretary of State's report. So the one report they found that didn't get reported was in my lab, and they totally misunderstood the issue there. So I think the whole premise of it as a scientist is incorrect.
All right, but Madam Chair, I'm just saying you said this is about protecting the water supplier. And
no, I didn't mean that.
Well, excuse me. I think it's about protecting the public. And we had testimony in my committee. And Ms. Meyer said this would be a huge burden on her company, and she would have to hire extra people. And at that time, I pushed and I said, well, what are we talking about? I mean, how often? And we're not talking about tests that are done for purposes of checking the system. We're talking about actual tests to determine public health. And how often per month do you have results that would need reporting? And at that time, you said about once a month.
Well, I don't know.
Excuse me. That was your answer about once a month.
Thank you, guys. Okay.
And I said, so your objection is the extra cost of sending one telefax one time a month. And that was a testimony that came in the committee, in my committee, where on the one hand you were complaining this is going to cause us to hire extra people, and then later you admitted that, well, really we're going to have to send one fax a month more than we do right now.
Okay.
That's just background for my committee, Madam
Chair.
All right.
Thank you. Ms. Myers, do you wish to respond to that?
I don't think it was one. I think it was five. I don't remember. And I don't know the figures because we weren't asked to. You know, I don't know what those would be. All I'm saying is I think the bill doesn't meet the need, and I understand it will probably go, and I understand we will probably do it, but I think you missed the boat with it.
So can you tell me, and I didn't have the hours of testimony that Senator Ringer had, so can you sort of just tell me what your concerns in terms of workload are for your company?
Well, we put out, say, a water system has to go through maybe 80 to 120 tests every few years, and we've got a lot of systems going through. Health Division has told us that we probably monitor the most systems in the state.
Okay.
And we
so
submit a lot of ours electronically.
To make sure that there's no bad stuff in it, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's very simple.
So if we've got a report that's got 40, 50 items on it, we're going to have to, you know, we've got maybe 30 of those a month or something. You're talking about perusing, and that's just one set of tests. You're talking about perusing inside these reports and just making sure, because despite what they say, I do believe it makes the lab somewhat responsible for reporting it.
Okay. But isn't that sort of your role in the system, is to report when you find bad things in the water?
To the water supplier.
To the water supplier.
It's the way the rule reads.
Okay.
And we do report for a large number of our clients electronically. The health division only takes micro electronically.
And so you think the burden should be on the water supplier, not on the tester?
Well, technically I do, though I'm really for making a lot of it more mandatory than it is, but I think what you're really trying to get falls outside the scope. I don't think you'll improve the public health because the problems in public health are outside the scope of this bill.
Okay. All right. Any questions for Ms. Myers? All right. Thank you very much. Anybody else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 1080?
All right. Representative Ms. Shibley, do you want to come up and respond to Ms. Myers' concerns?
Madam Chair, for the record, again, I'm Gail Shibley, and joining me is my drinking water protection manager, Dave Leland.
Hello.
Hi.
And I'm not, honestly, Madam Chair, I'm not quite sure exactly where to begin, if it's a workload issue or if it's a, certainly in terms of overall their drinking water assurance, if you will, regulatory oversight, whether it's at the state or the local level in the state of Oregon, does not have enough resources to fully discharge all of our responsibilities under EPA requirements. We are dealing with that with the House bill, House Bill 2171, that we would love to have coming your way, if we could get it across the building, that would in fact increase the resources overall for a whole bunch of things. But in terms of this specific issue, this was identified as a critical weakness. We think this solution. This is a real weakness. We agree with the Secretary of State's report, as we agree with all the other points in the Secretary of State's report. And we believe that this narrowly crafted language is the size of the solution that fits this problem. It's a small but critical number of results that we don't know, we don't get, and we can't solve a problem that we don't know about.
Mr. Water Tester?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I would just echo what Gail said and really emphasize again the focused nature of this particular solution. And, you know, when it came out in the Secretary of State audit report, they're really suggesting that all reports, you know, be sent to the department. And the truth is very, very few of regular water tests from, you know, from public water systems in Oregon show bad results. And that's good, you know, because what we want in Oregon is safe drinking water. But the fact that they were able to locate some tests with bad results in lab files that we didn't have, you know, caused us a lot of concern, even though, you know, maybe there weren't that many of them. But how many do you need to not come in so that, you know, maybe actions don't get taken in an appropriate manner to protect the public's health? So I think it gets at two things. One, a right size solution to a problem stated. And then secondly, I think it really helped the credibility of the public health system if there was a kind of a backstop of making sure that the bad tests do in fact come to the department so that we can deal with them.
Questions?
Thank you.
Questions?
Senator Ferriero. Thank you, Madam Chair. I, as a city councilor in a city that had a problem with arsenic in the wells, it really had to do with the season of the year and the infiltration and the flow. And, we, you know, the city was pretty diligent in watching the results, the lab test results. And very often it was a matter of us remediating that with backflow or hard pumping of the well to change the test results, lower the concentration by dilution, etc. If we had forwarded the reports to the state laboratory, what would be your response? You know, if a water system serving the public had a test that showed a spike in heavy metals, what would your response be?
Madam Chair and Senator Ferrioli, what we want to do, or what we always do, is when we get positive tests in the office, something that's over the limit, even a single test, we make sure we make contact right away with the water supplier to make sure everybody understands what that means, make sure we have all the facts, and really have that dialogue about whether or not there's a public health problem so that it can be dealt with. So in your case, maybe with your community, we would be in contact and just providing consultation, giving more advice, listening to what the water supplier is doing, maybe being able to validate that, maybe having other things that would be good to do. So it opens that dialogue if everyone has all the facts.
Madam Chair. Would it help if you speak slowly and distinctly to the city council and the mayor about their problem?
Oh yes, absolutely.
Senator, I'm being a little facetious here. The people that operate the systems know very well what the limits are and the parameters are, and they're really concerned about public health.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. So to have every single report from every single lab go to the state, do you have the personnel to tickle through every one of those files? They have to be tested monthly, don't they? So aren't you going to generate a huge volume of material that have to be reviewed?
Madam Chair and Senator Ferrioli, we receive the results now. We have a huge database that all the results go into. We receive them now. What we're concerned about is those few that were found that we didn't receive. Mm-hmm. And so we're receiving most, something like probably 80% of the sample results we get overall. And the ones we don't get, we send letters to water systems saying, hey, we didn't hear from you. And the vast majority of the ones that we don't get are safe results. I mean, they're okay. They just didn't come in on time. They didn't come in within the time frame. But we have the database in place to put all the test results in so that we can show that everybody has done all the testing they're supposed to do. So this isn't a real large workload issue for us. What we're trying to do is capture any bad tests that might be out there that didn't get reported like they should have.
Thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1080. I'm sorry, Representative McPherson, why don't you come up? Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about House Bill 3223? We got so engrossed in that bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 3223, as we said earlier, allows major political parties to determine dates for organizational meetings of their county central committees.
Thank you. You got volunteered for service because we wanted to know why we needed this bill. So.
And I'll try to do my best, Madam Chair, to explain that. For the record, I'm Representative Greg McPherson, House District 38, and this bill was brought forward to me and to my fellow chief sponsor, Representative Patty Smith, by the party committees of Multnomah County, both Republican and Democratic. It was a surprise to me to learn when this issue was brought forward is how closely structured state statute is about when the party organizations hold their county organizational meetings and their state central committee meetings. And it seems like an odd thing for state statutes to address, but they do. And this bill simply gives a little more flexibility in that the timing of those meetings. Specifically, with respect to county central committee meetings, the current law requires that the meeting be held between 6 and 50 days after the primary election when precinct committee people are elected. And the state central committee meetings are to be held between the 55th and 75th day after the general election. And what this bill would do is it would give complete flexibility as to when in a 25-month period the county organizational committee meeting would be held. It would be done on notice to the people who have been elected to precinct positions, and similarly would provide that the state central committee meeting would be held on a date fixed in accordance with the bylaws of the state central committee. As I mentioned earlier, was a bill that was proposed by the county organizations from Multnomah County, and it's our the understanding from the presentation that was made by representatives of each of those party organizations that the state organization concurs in the change that affects the holding of the state meeting. Unfortunately, I wasn't paying close enough attention to the noticing of this hearing, so I wasn't able to arrange for those people to come and attend as they did on the House side, but we had a good and full explanation of the reasons for this in front of the House Rules Committee, and it was passed out unanimously, and then I jointly carried it with Representative Smith on the floor, and although I wasn't able to alert her to come and join me, this is a bipartisan bill, and I think in the right spirit for our winding this session of the legislature up in a satisfactory manner.
Thank you, Representative McPherson. Questions? I think you did the trick.
Okay.
Anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 3223? Okay, we're going to close the public hearing. We're going to be in recess for 15 minutes. Huh. House Bill 3197, move into work session. There are no amendments to 3197. I'll move House Bill 3197 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing seeing none? So ordered. Who'd like to carry? Okay, don't all scream at once.
I'd love to.
Thank you, Senator Atkinson. All right. Close the public work session. Open a work session on House Bill 3223. No amendments to House Bill 3223 allows political parties to determine their own organizational meetings within certain parameters. Any discussion about this bill? Any objection to this bill? Did I move it? I can't remember. I'm moving so fast.
You did not move it.
I did not. Okay, good. See? Mm-hmm. I move House Bill 3223 to Senate floor with the due pass recommendations. Objections? None. So ordered. Sarah Ringo, would you please carry?
Yes, ma'am. You didn't ask for discussion. You just...
Because we'd already had given you an opportunity to discuss it and nobody said anything.
I just had to point that out.
All right. Close the public hearing and close the work session on 3223. Open a work session on 3252. This is a fairly straightforward bill that several people wanted to testify, but we wouldn't let them to explain four words. Chair would move the bill to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
I sure would like to name this after Andy Miller and make it go faster.
any objection? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. Who'd like to carry?
Okay.
All right, Senator Shields, thank you.
Can I do it at 65 mile an hour?
You can do it at whatever speed you want. Close the work session, open a work session in House Bill 3257. No amendments. Chair would move the bill to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection?
Object.
Senator Farrioli objects. Do we hear a second? Objection? No. Okay. All right. Motion carries. I'll carry the bill. All right. Open a work session. Thank you for reminding me on House Bill 3272. This is the QBS bill. Any discussion? Chair would move the bill to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any objections?
I'll be voting no.
Okay. Any more objections? Okay. Motion carries.
I'll take it.
You will?
Maybe not.
I will.
Now they're fighting over it.
Ringo wants it too? We can drop this
one. Madam Chair, we've learned that if we volunteer, we probably won't get it. So.
I really don't want it. Just vote no.
Okay. All right, Sarah Atkinson, you win since you asked first.
Really?
Yes.
There goes that rule.
I'm on ice cream today. I'm doing everything differently. Okay, close the public work session on 3272. I'm not going to tell you.
Tell me on the record.
I'm older than you.
By how much?
Open the work session on House Bill 3301, at least a decade.
So if I'm... Plus.
Okay, we have a dash three. All right, we've got the dash three amendments. Representative Holvey has the dash three amendments. My understanding is the special districts are concerned about the dash three amendments. Is that correct? Anybody here from special districts?
Madam Chair, we had no discussion of the dash three amendments. I just point that out. That,
we're moving a lot of bills and we're getting our numbers lost. Nobody? Okay. All right. Chair would move House Bill 3301 to the Senate floor with due pass recommendations. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing seeing none. So ordered. We're going to let, what is from Lane County? We'll let the Lane County delegation carry the bill.
The entire delegation?
Three people? They can each say a few words. All right. Close the work session on House Bill 3301. Open a work session on House Bill 3318. We have no amendments. Chair would move the bill to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendations. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Who'd like to carry this bill?
Might be the worst first workers' comp bill I got to carry this.
Thank you, Senator Shields. We'll let you carry the bill. I do think that MLAC should explore the possibility of a indexing on the dollar amount on this medical services, but I didn't want to hold up the bill at this time. All right. Close the work session. Open a work session on House Bill 3329. We have the dash 5 amendments. The chair would move the dash 5 amendments to House Bill 3329. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none. So ordered. Chair would move House Bill 3329 as amended with the dash 5 to Senate floor with due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none. So ordered. Senator Shields or Ringo, would you like to carry?
Oh, sure.
Okay. Thanks for volunteering.
Yeah.
Yes. Close the work session. Open a work session on House Bill 3419. This is the sex offenders can't live together without supervision bill. Okay. Thank you. Ms. Harris, the chair would move the dash 2 amendments, which are conflict amendments, to House Bill 3419. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. The chair would move House Bill 3419 as amended with the dash 2 amendments to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Madam Chair?
Senator Ringo.
I was just going to mention that there's another bill in this committee that I worked on about where sex offenders can live. And I think based on some of the definitions in here, I will apply the same definitions to that other bill so that they fit well.
Great.
But I hope we move that bill within a few days as well.
All right. I look forward to hearing and talking with you about that particular bill. Any further discussion? Any objection to the bill? So ordered. Would you like to carry this one then too, Ms. Ringo?
Sure.
Okay. All right. Close the work session. Open a work session on House Bill 3443. We need to, Chair would move the dash 3 amendments, which provide that there is no fiscal impact. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing seeing none. So ordered. Chair would move House Bill 3443 as amended to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Yeah. I've just absolutely loved this bill for years, all the work we've done in this city. Relative to getting it for people, this would have been a great thing to have had 20 years ago.
All right. Well, sometimes good things take a long time.
Yep.
All right, Senator Shields, thanks for your comments. Any objection to the bill moving to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation? Hearing seeing none. So ordered. Senator Shields, thanks for volunteering to carry the bill.
Thank you. That'll be a fun one.
I don't know where Ms. went, but oh, there she is. Okay, thanks for all your hard work. Appreciate seeing folks from my district on occasion. Close the work session on House Bill 3443. Open a work session on House Bill 3468. This excludes Yellow Pages from Unlawful Trade Practices Acts. There are no amendments. Chair would move the bill to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Chair appreciates the concern of the Department of Justice. If it's a problem, we'll obviously need to address the issue next session. But
Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo.
I mean, I was in for part of this hearing. I am somewhat concerned about this as well. I mean, I think you have the votes from the committee, but I think we need to do more to protect consumers, and I don't know that this does it.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Ringo. Any further discussion? Would you please call the roll?
Senator Atkinson?
Yes.
Senator Ringo?
Hi.
Senator Shields?
Hi.
Chair Caroli?
Aye.
Chair Brown?
Chair votes aye. Motion carries. Who'd like to carry? I'll carry it. Holy smokes, you guys.
Holy smokes, the church is on fire.
All right. Moving into hotly contested territory. Close the public hearing on 3468. I mean, it's a work session. Open a work session on 3479. We have no amendments to the bill. Oh, we do. Dash one amendments. Okay, hang on. Let me pull that bill file so it goes in front of me. Ah, yes. Chair would move the dash one amendments to House Bill 3479. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Yes? Okay. Chair would move House Bill 3479 as amended by the dash one amendments to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? Hearing seeing none? So ordered. I'm happy to let you carry the bill, Senator Farioli, as long as we don't have a conversation about what the city of Portland ought to do with their electricity. Is that fair?
Madam Chair, we'll only be talking about what the city of Portland should not be doing with PGE.
Yes. Well, that's not really germane, Senator Farioli, so.
No problem.
I will. Keep me on my toes. Okay, close the work session, open work session on House Bill 3482. No amendments. Chair would move the bill to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing seeing none. So ordered. I'm going to have Senator Bates carry that bill. So I do believe I have a fairly compelling personal story.
That was the purple waiter.
Yes. Close the work session on House Bill 3482. Open work session on HJM 35. Any discussion? Chair would move the bill to the Senate floor with a due adopt recommendation. Any objection? Hearing seeing none. So ordered. Senator Farioli, did you want to carry that bill? Okay. We're going to let Senator Farioli carry. Last but not least, move into work session on Senate Bill 1080. No amendments, correct? All right. Chair would move Senate Bill 1080 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Would you please call the roll?
Senator Atkinson?
No.
Senator Ringo?
Aye.
Senator Steele?
Aye.
Vice Chair Farioli?
Aye.
Chair Brown?
Chair votes aye. Motion carries. Senator Ringo, I'm going to let you carry that bill, since you obviously have far superior knowledge than anyone else on the committee of those particular issues. All right. Oh, don't get excited. We have another bill to draft.
This is a good one.
No.
Oh.
Now, will this facilitate the end of the session?
And, Senator Farioli, I will let you know that in terms of work environments, there's no place I'd rather be. Would I rather be out playing today? Yes, of course. But if I have to actually work, there's no other place I would rather be than here. So there.
Madam, what spurred that totally extraneous and unheard outburst?
The fact that you said I was lying when I said I wouldn't rather be anywhere else.
Ice cream did it.
No? All right. We are under bill introductions and drafting. This is a pretty important motion, you guys.
Is it the sign and die motion?
I am moving. I'm asking for your support to request legislative counsel to draft and introduce the sign-and-die resolution as a rules committee measure.
Happy birthday to you.
Senator Farioli.
Happy birthday to you.
Hopefully it will
Everyone.
Be soon. No,
Happy
you guys don't.
Birthday, Senator Big Older Sister Kate Brown.
You guys are good.
He's good.
Yeah.
Happy
he needed an older sister.
What's that?
You needed an older sister.
Oh,
it was
Lord
something
knows.
Missing in your life.
It's not missing now.
Is that because you got married?
To you.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah, that's right.
There's a motion on the floor to allow legislative council to draft and to allow Senate committee to introduce the sign-e-die resolution.
Okay.
Is there any discussion? Senator Farrelly.
So cool.
I don't think you're a religious person, but this is a prayer, not a motion. This proves.
Let's have a moment of silence for it, then.
Okay, we just had our moment. Thank you very much. Seeing no objection to my motion.
Will it in any way delay?
Any further business to come into the
committee?
You didn't
give the caveat.
I am not giving that caveat. All right.
Okay.
We're out of here. We've got an alternative.